This is the Division 2, Division 3 podcast.
Welcome to the Inside Lacrosse Division 2, Division 3 podcast. I am Matt Kinnear, back this week here along with Josh Davey sitting beside me here in the Inside Lacrosse studio in Baltimore. And Kyle Devitt up in New Hampshire, just made the trip to Maryland and back for the Mustang Classic. And that's going to be the topic of most of the discussion here today on this podcast. 8 ranked teams, 10 teams in total, met at Stevenson University's Mustang Stadium Friday and Saturday for the biggest event of the D3 season outside of the championship game. Josh, you didn't actually get to watch any of it. You got to watch some of it, but you were at a bachelor party in New Orleans. I'm sure you would have rather been in Owings Mills, Maryland. Am I right?
There were times where, you know, we were having a great time down there. It was an amazing weekend. I was sitting on the couch and we were watching a lot of college basketball, and I was watching something on my phone. A lot of the guys, I thought, just assumed, like, oh, he's watching the Michigan State game because we're watching the whatever game that's on. And a couple guys were looking at me. I was like, no, this is Middlebury Dickinson. They're like, you're watching the D3 NCAA tournament. I was like, no, this is D3 lacrosse. And I tried to explain what it was. So, yeah, it was great. I got to catch out moments. Luckily, our boy Kyle Devitt was in overload mode, keeping everyone up to date, everything all weekend. So I think I have an okay grasp of what went on, but I'm excited to hear from you guys. But it was a great weekend. Still recovering a little bit, but I'm excited to officially hit the refresh button here with this D3 podcast and move forward. So looking forward to hearing what you guys saw this weekend.
Kyle, you flew back to New Hampshire last night. I saw getting on your flight, you downloaded some Metallica for the flight, so I'm sure you were pretty amped up getting home. What would you say about your trip down here?
Yeah, it was probably a mistake to download the Metallica and then pull out the card that said Boeing 737 on it.
Oh.
So that was a weird kind of moment there. Apparently, it's a different model that got recalled, so we're good. I was kind of, emotional leaving just because, like, you don't get a lot of experiences like the Mustang Classic covering any sport. You know, I think we're kind of, maybe sometimes we take it for granted that the games that we cover are just games. And sometimes they're not. Sometimes they mean more and you can get more value out of them and really get into them. And you can see what it means to the coaches, the players, and everybody in the community when you cover those games. You get a ton of feedback. I mean, the easiest way to measure that is feedback on Twitter and people kind of like having a banter there. But we wrote articles about pretty much every game. I think we both watched, I'm going to say 70% of the games, and 100% between the both of us, obviously. But it was an intense experience for sure. I don't know if I could watch 4 D1 games back to back and try to write recaps, but I know that I can do it for D3 now. I don't really think I should. But it was definitely fun to do it at this event, and I can't thank the organizers enough, Stevenson, all the colleges there, and all the coaches for their time.
Kyle, I've been to this event many times now. I think I've been 4 or 5 years to the Mustang Classic, which is basically as long as it's been in existence. And so I had a pretty good idea of what to expect going into it. Kyle, what was your thought overall on the event in terms of just what your expectations were versus what you saw in terms of just the intensity of the gameplay, the logistics of the event and how it's run, those things? What were maybe some of your things that you thought were different or things you thought were that you expected going into it?
Well, first off, I've never been to a D3 stadium experience that's quite on that level ever. I've never seen that. I didn't think it was possible. I've never been to Stevenson before. I was blown away by the actual facility. It's better than a lot of D1 places that I've been, especially up here. No shots, but shots. In the last, 4 years covering games for IL and Division I, I think that the overall vibe, too, was very, it was professional grade. And some of the games were also professional grade. There are, there are several guys, particularly RIT and Amherst, and, we'll get to that game eventually, star the entire tournament. Great call, Josh and I, last week's pod. Check that out. We prophesized an amazing game, and we got more than we thought we'd get. I think that also, you know, the actual atmosphere of the event is, you know, it's encouraging, I guess, is like the best word I can think of. It's very like, it's almost validating in that it was so complete. Right. You had all these parents and you know, students. I believe Stevenson was on spring break, and it still seemed like there was a ton of people in the stadium. The parking lot outside the stadium was full. So I assume all those people were in there for a reason, checking out some great games. And, you know, you couldn't really go wrong. There was something great that happened in each game. There were a lot of players that stood out to me that I haven't seen or didn't get it, give a second look to, that got second, third, and sometimes fourth looks for me, that I, you know, I'm going to remember that when it comes time to vote for All-Americans for sure.
Josh, have you ever played in Mustang Stadium?
I have played in Mustang Stadium. So my sophomore year, it was the year before they built it. So we played on the grass, which is basically equivalent. I think they have volleyball right there now. Mm-hmm. So behind where the benches were, I played there my sophomore year. And my senior year, I played twice at Mustang Stadium, one of which was my last career game. So I have some memories, not necessarily the best ones. And then the next year was the year the Mustang Classic started. So I believe it was 2014.
It definitely is, you know, the creme de la creme of Division III stadiums and the experience. And shout out to all the people behind the scenes. You know, they have a whole multimedia effort of people calling the games, doing play-by-play for the live broadcast. They do interviews that are on the Stevenson University website and YouTube that are were executed after each game. All the sports information people from, you know, people who are on staff at Stevenson to the interns to just, you know, the people to, like, the logistics of getting teams in and out of the locker rooms. You know, there's people behind the scenes who make all this stuff happen. And there's a reason it's kind of a professional grade event, is because of all these people and Coach Canabine, who, you know, if you're there, he's there from the first game to the end of the night the whole time, and he's nonstop. So a lot goes into it to allow us to watch all these teams. But let's talk about the important stuff, the games, the players, the teams that we saw. Kyle, what maybe is one or two of your just biggest takeaways about the gameplay after this weekend?
I think the number one thing, and I know that this is kind of a conclusion we both share, so I don't want to completely step on it for you, but the biggest thing I took away from this is that Amherst is absolutely a D3 national championship contender.
That is 100% true. The thing that really impressed me most, and I was talking to some people beforehand who kind of, even before these games, were saying Amherst is really legit. They are going to be a national championship contender, because I think we all knew that they were a top 10, top 5 kind of caliber team. But that next leap to national championship contender, even though it's just a few ranking spaces, is enormous. So I think we were all kind of questioning whether they were a championship team. They showed it this weekend. And the reason why, most of all, that it was kind of clear to me was the things that were their weaknesses, or at least the perceived weaknesses of this team, are really strengths. You know, Coach Don Thompson said after their win against RIT that this team has a spine. And he meant it in two ways. One, in terms of just the overall toughness and ability to kind of not crumble in the face of adversity like they had in that RIT game, but also just with, you know, legitimately the spine, from the goalie to the faceoff to, you know, a kind of a quarterback who can run their offense. And Chad Simmons, you know, played excellent during this whole weekend, against Franklin and Marshall. He had 22 saves. He played a really good game against RIT as well. Juan Gonzalez is, you know, the faceoff specialist who's kind of stepped in wake of injuries at that position. And you would have thought that that was a weakness for them, but he had a heck of a game. And you know, Amherst dominated possession against RIT, and that's a big part of the reason why they won. So really, like, the things we might have questioned this Amherst team on going into the season, this weekend showed me those are all taken care of. They're really good. Kyle, the thing that I most remember you talking about while we were sitting there in the press box was this ride from Amherst and just general the way you were impressed with their poles and the way they were able to execute this ride. What did you see there?
Yeah, I think first of all, I mean this in the most positive way possible, that those polls are mean. Like mean in a way that's like legal, but really mean. And that's kind of something you look for in teams that are challenging for a Division III national championship. I mean, ask anyone in Salisbury. Mean polls. That's how it goes. That's how they do it. Tufts, mean polls. Wesleyan, super mean polls. You know, I think that's a compliment. Otherwise, the ride itself, okay, I sat there and tried to figure out, because they did change it a couple times, but the crux of the, like, philosophy behind the ride is letting teams carry over the midline and then back-checking and trapping. And they did it in different ways. They did it by pulling back, you know, a midfielder that kind of looked like an attackman that let the guy pass, and then a pull met him and turned him into the back check, which is genius, first of all, because everyone, when you're thinking about the clear clock, right, you got 20 seconds, and the clear clock is a much bigger player, I think, than people realize when teams have great rides, right? And I think 2-1, almost every team here had a very drilled and disciplined ride, and I think you could say that last year. I wouldn't think that would be true about a lot of teams, but you saw that guys knew where to go right off a save. Like, usually the polls and the defense kind of dictate where the coverage goes after a save, because they'll break out and they'll go to space to set up the clear. But with Amherst ride in particular, you just see guys turn and run to the midline. And you're like, all right, I mean, I guess they're letting the polls do it. And then there's one guy open who everyone brings that guy back to catch that short pass, and usually it's a short stick, and he runs up. Amherst throws a check on him, slows him down, so he's got a little bit of panic in him when he has to cross the half line. And then, like I said, they'll bring another pull up, trap. Sometimes they'll pull the goalie out, sometimes they won't. They did get a couple shots taken on them because they did that a little early and did kind of a 10-man. But that zone where the back checker comes from the other side of the half line, when you already think you're safe right before you get in the restraining box, is like masterful. I want tape on it. I want to break it down and just like ingest it and know it forever. It was the best ride scheme that I've seen. RIT did a similar thing where they would send actually an attackman over if they had to kind of chase and then pull another guy back and again jump the middle to make sure there's no easy runs to the center of the field. But yeah, I was just really blown away by everyone's ride, but in particular Amherst and RIT's.
Kyle, this Amherst RIT game, as you said, was clearly the star of the show for this weekend. It was just one of those games that, like, you're just happy we got to see it in person. We couldn't even really talk to each other because every time we were in the middle of something, there was another goal. 18-17 win. This game kind of shifted in the third quarter where Amherst had a 5-goal run that, you know, they were down pretty big, and they turned that into a tie game going into the fourth quarter and were able to kind of just be one goal better than RIT going into this. So really kind of a tough win for Amherst, showcased a lot of their positives. You know, the thing that really we haven't talked about, we talked about their polls, but I don't know if they get enough credit for just their straight 6-on-6 defense that really was kind of, I think, a strength down the stretch in this game. They were able to actually play some, you know, solid defense in possession. But I'm walking away from this game still of the mindset that RIT could win the national championship this year. And I also think that Sean Nally is the best player in the country. Josh, what do you have to say about RIT?
No, that was going to be my question. Is this is the game that I was following along the most on Twitter. And it's funny because Sean Nally in our Facebook yearbook is a preseason first-team All-American. But for some reason, his name doesn't like necessarily resonate as much as like a Chad Levick or a Ryan Lee for these guys who you're used to hearing at RIT. So just looking at our preseason ranking or preseason All-Americans, Sean Nally was a first team All-American preseason. Their goalie Walker Hare was a preseason All-American. I believe they had Trevor Smith, one of their LSM, and another close defenseman, and Alex Maruna. So these are names that, you know, my South bias showing, like, you know, I don't know if you guys each want to take one of them, but, like, you know, I'm more familiar with Sean Nally, who had 12 points over the weekend. But, you know, between the goalie, you talk about the spine of that Amherst team. You know, what can you say about the RIT defense? Because that's the the thing that I'm least familiar with. Obviously, they gave up 17 goals in this game, but they also held York to 6 the day before. So I'm interested in hearing your guys' perspective on what made those guys special. Because that's a side, you know, isn't as sexy as the offense necessarily.
To one of your points, Josh, I think that this is one of those teams that you don't know an individual's name because there's, you know, really 10 guys you could talk about, and they kind of cancel each other out in terms of, you know, there's not necessarily, maybe Nally is an exception here, but there's not as much of just that one guy who carries the team as this is pretty much an entire team effort. Kyle, I think about their defense, you could probably talk about it best having seen that York RIT game. You covered that one, and that was just a different pace than this Amherst RIT game. What did you see from the RIT polls?
Yeah, I was really impressed with three guys in particular, but the first one is Patrick Schumme. Hopefully I'm saying that right. When we were watching the Amherst game, I wasn't sure where everyone was from, and then I watched them play for like 5 seconds, and I'm like, that guy's Canadian, that guy's upstate. And I almost nailed it. I got one wrong. But I feel like that's what makes the team dangerous, is that there is no fear in these polls. There is zero fear. They're madmen. They're running through checks. They're running through balls into scrums, knocking people over, getting the ball up and out, helping and hedging on defense when it doesn't look like they're doing it. They do a great job of kind of that fake hip turn so that when the ball carrier looks toward where he's going, they'll kind of do that secondary look out of the corner eye to see if the defenseman's going. And they do a great job of feigning not going and then running in for a back check. In particular, you know, Schumme, like I mentioned, and other guys like Trevor Smith and Matt Pogue, both seniors from Orangeville and Mississauga, respectively. I thought they were incredible. Like, it wasn't like I saw teams like Dickinson, for example, and Nate Usich is easily their most impactful poll. I would have a hard time picking out who was more skilled or better or leading the pack out of those three guys than I would on probably any other team we saw. Like, they were very not interchangeable in a way that kind of makes them less valued, but more valued because they're all multi-skill players and they love carrying the ball. There's a we had Jackie Borowski follow around RIT for these two games, and she showed me some of the video highlights that she was shooting. And one of the plays, it's not going to make a highlight reel, and we decided, we were talking together, oh, we should keep that in. It's a long pull BTB catch and turn on the crease to a wide open cutting attackman, and the attackman misses the goal, so it's not going to be on a highlight package or anything. But it was so incredible when you watch, like, there's just the guys push all the way down. They let the poles make decisions. They're so trusted. I think I tweeted something about this. They were so trusting of the ball carriers that I was like blown away. Like, that's when you're a coach and you see a long pole ring the ball up, there's always a little thing in the back of your head that's like, pass it, pass it, pass it, pass it, pass it, pass it. And I didn't feel that once for RIT, and I don't think their coaches feel that for them either.
Kyle, you said no fear, and that was really my main takeaway for Nally, and as well the midfielders and attack for this group. There were so many times that they were running towards the net as fast as possible, and I was kind of taken aback, like, oh my God, this guy's going to kill himself running into the goalpost here. It's like they're hockey players who are just transposed onto a lacrosse field with the way that they're so good and tight. You know, they're not afraid to dive into the crease, to get into the dirty spaces and kind of take a hit, go as fast as they can. You know, the example would be like kind of running out and icing in hockey before the icing rules changed. Like, you know, you're going to get either hit into the boards or you're just going to collide into the boards on your own, but you're still going to do it because you can make a play out of it. RIT was as good as any team in that regard, as tough, as hard-nosed as anyone.
I have a question for you guys. So part of what's cool about this event is, I believe the NESCAC, I know the ODAC, and maybe even the Centennial Conference, those conference tournaments in, you know, end of April, early May, they play either Friday, Sunday, semis, championship, or Saturday, Sunday. So I know when we were playing, you know, we would try to schedule before this event existed, you know, a Saturday, Sunday game to get ready for the inevitable, okay, we're hopefully going to be, you know, in the ODAC tournament playing for a championship. We have to get used to playing on a Saturday, Sunday back-to-back, or in this case, it was a Friday, Saturday. So did you see, and I have other questions to kind of go along with that, but did you guys see any drop off in terms of, you know, how are guys' legs? Were they still fresh from day one to day two? Or is that something that you didn't think was very noticeable?
Well, Kyle, I saw the Dickinson win over Middlebury the first day. You saw them lose on the second day. What, you know, what was kind of the problem with them on the second day? Obviously, there was, you know, an injury that was part of it. So that's part of the whole playing two games in 2 days. But did you get the sense that the team maybe just kind of had no gas in the tank from the night prior?
Well, I think there was two injuries. One actually happened in the second game. They lost their faceoff guy. But the first injury happened in the first game for them when they beat Denison. And that was DeMuth, one of their top defensive midfielders, who also helps in their clear, went down and didn't play in the second game. And then losing the faceoff guy, Nate Usage, again, to bring him up, stepped in as a pole and started taking draws and let the guy win and then took the ball away. You know, that was a big part of how they, you know, went after teams. I think that going against Middlebury was fresher because I think that they understood that first game. They didn't expend a ton of energy because that game was kind of over early when they lost to Wesleyan on the first day. And when Dickinson played them, Dickinson went through a war with Denison, right? That was a war on that first day. So when they ran into the Middlebury team, and in particular Gould, Middlebury's faceoff guy, who somehow isn't a faceoff guy, but is actually really good at faceoffs, according to the Coach Campbell after the game, they just ran a buzzsaw. And Dickinson kept trying to adjust, kept trying to find answers, and it just, they couldn't score enough goals late. And I think that when you take, here's the thing with a lot of these teams. If you take one cog out of the machine and you don't have a similar cog to pop in there to fill in at least temporarily, there's problems and there's an adjustment period. And the quick turnaround makes that adjustment period almost impossible, especially if that guy's a huge player. And I think that we saw that with them in particular.
Yeah, Kyle, and you brought up a good point about, you know, the battle that they played in the first day against Denison. You know, they shout out, you know, I think Middlebury maybe owes an assist to Denison on that win there, because the first quarter definitely of that Dickinson-Denison game, I was like, man, Dickinson should be running away with this. But it was 3-3 after the first quarter. It ended up separating a little bit. It was 9-4. But Denison kept at them this whole game. And they've really kind of made them work for that win, even though, like, a lot of the numbers really kind of said that this should have been a Dickinson blowout, particularly the way that Denison struggled with the clear. But I really like their Brooks Davey. He's a player for them who, no relation to Josh here.
Great last name.
He's kind of an unassisted goal guy. You know, he's just got that ability to, up top, really just kind of muscle through a guy, get to the center of the field and get a good shot off. He had a really, really good game, really impressive. But overall, just Denison, you know, I thought there was times when maybe when Peter Petroff was shut out a little bit, they didn't have enough firepower behind them to really make something happen. But they certainly battled this whole game and really gave Dickinson a very tough time and made Dickinson's weekend that much harder by what they were able to do to them on Friday.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. I think also if you're looking at Denison, you know, in the second game, against Franklin and Marshall, Peter Petroff goes off for 8 points and Spencer Butler scores 7 goals. So it's not like something was broken. It's something like Dickinson's defense is actually legit and schemed against those two players in particular to kind of hold them under their normally spectacular stat lines. And then you saw Denison kind of freed from those shackles of that Dickinson defense and the faceoff, and they just went at F&M. I mean, it was kind of ugly, but the good news for F&M, another guy who got held in the first day, Kevin Mulhan, scores 6 goals and 1 assist to kind of get off the schneid for that second game. They just couldn't get a win.
Yeah, and what's cool about, you know, just the time of year it is right now is, you know, I don't want to just transition to Lynchburg because, you know, they kind of had a not boring weekend, but, you know, they were 1-1, and I have a couple questions coming away from some of those games that you guys watched in more depth than I did, but like I think teams are still figuring out who they are and where the right pieces are. You know, I'm looking at some of the box scores here, and I went to see Lynchburg play Elizabethtown 2 weeks ago, and Trammell Robinson didn't play 1 second of that game. a guy who played a lot last year, hasn't been getting a lot of minutes this year. And then this weekend, you look at the stat sheet, he had a goal and assist against Stevenson and a goal and assist against Wesleyan. So I think, to your point about people going down, Miles Hyann for FNM having, you know, maybe a goose egg or whatever on Saturday and then coming out and playing great on Sunday or Friday and Saturday, I think people are still trying to figure out personnel. And when one guy goes out, right, Witherell goes out for WNL, who's the next guy to step up? And those things are still forming, whereas you would think it would happen earlier in the season. I think now that you're playing these back-to-back games, guys are getting tired. You have to go a little bit deeper into your bench, especially on a weekend like this. So I think that's really interesting. And sort of pivoting from there, I have a question sort of each for both you and Matt. We talked about this a little bit pre-podcast, but you know, for Lynchburg specifically, and they might be the only team that falls under this category, you know, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, prepping for this weekend, you play Stevenson on a Friday night, run and gun, fast, up and down kind of team. You know how they want to play. And then you have Wesleyan on Saturday. You know they run a zone. It's going to just inherently be a slower game. So one of my questions, I'll go to you, Matt, because I know you talked to Coach Rabba about this a little bit about Wesleyan. But then, Kyle, my question to you for afterwards would be, how do you prep for that? Like, are you confident in your own abilities enough that you just go in, hey, we've played a zone once before, you know, went okay for us, wasn't amazing. You know, how do you sort of splice up that week? And these are the things we need to worry about this game. Or do you just say, you know, we're just going to worry about ourselves? So Matt, why don't you hit first on just the sort of the piece that Coach Rabba hit about that you had a conversation with?
Yeah. So on Friday, I talked to Coach Rabba just essentially like, what's the rest of your weekend look like? And he joked that, you know, every parent had been asking the same exact question. He actually was able to go see his son score his first collegiate point on Saturday for Loyola, which was a great moment for him. Happy he got to experience that in person. But the thing that he said that, you know, resonated about preparing for their game against Lynchburg was the fact that Wesleyan played well against Middlebury on Friday meant he didn't feel like he needed to work on Wesleyan over Friday night into Saturday. He was able to focus on Lynchburg. So I think a lot of the preparation that you do, I think you prepare for maybe the thing that's the most unique that you have to deal with. So, if I'm Lynchburg, maybe I'm going to work on zone and practice that week and figure out what to do there, because that's the thing that, you know, I know they've played it a few times and have a few teams in their schedule that use it, but obviously that's the thing that's most outside the box. But I think most of the time, you're really just looking at yourself and then reacting to what happens on Friday. So Wesleyan had this kind of built-in advantage of, all right, we feel pretty good about ourselves. We can watch this Lynchburg game, maybe take down a few notes, watch a little bit of film, and kind of prepare for it. But overall, we're not, you know, fixing anything that's broke with ourselves. You know, we don't need to shuffle up our lineups. They did have one injury that they had to address with their midfield, but for the most part, they had kind of a built-in luxury of that. And Lynchburg, I think, to some extent, had the best of both worlds coming out of that Stevenson game. Some stuff to work on a little bit because of the way that game started, but also ending on a positive note, coming back to win that game. You know, they probably were in a little bit of a similar boat of being able to go into Wesleyan and like, all right, we're going to focus on them. I think we're pretty well taken care of on our own. But Coach Kadelka, at the end of the event, after that, you know, talked about how much he felt his team grew. And my takeaway from Lynchburg is that no team grew as much or learned as much out of this weekend than they did, partially because of that, playing two teams that are vastly different, a team that's going to run and gun, being in a situation where you're going to have to fight back and get back into that game and score a bunch of goals, and then kind of being in more of a nip and tuck game against Wesleyan where you're going to face a unique defense and see what you can do there. And they also had to battle back a little bit as well. But I think they learned and grew more than any team in this event.
I actually, first of all, shout out to the coaches for amazing quotes all weekend. I'm used to interviewing like D1 guys who are like, you know, we're just doing our best to try and get out there and compete with the other team. And our guys work really hard this week. Yeah, I don't care. So Kudelka, quote of the weekend. I interviewed him after the come-from-behind win against Stevenson on Friday night. And it's like 10:30 or something like that. And he goes, you know, this is a man's game. That was the message in one of the huddles. If they're going to put three poles up top, then you have to be a man and run past some people. We pushed and pushed and earned the win tonight. No one gave it to us. Stevenson didn't give it. We earned it. They played with great energy, great passion. They played the way Lynchburg plays. That's a coach quote for everybody. That is like amazing. That's what you say to guys in the locker room to get them fired up. And if it's enough to fire up the person covering the game, it's a pretty good quote.
Having flashbacks right now.
Yeah, I bet you are. He was like right in my face too. I was like, oh, okay. All right. And he's a tall guy. So he's really kind of like stooping over to really get in there. But I think that that's kind of something that, you know, I now understand about Lynchburg. You know, that quote makes me understand that this is a team that, despite wins and losses, is going to be in every game. And that's probably not something that – it's definitely not something I thought at the beginning of the year, but it's definitely a unique characteristic amongst a lot of these top 5, top 10, top 15 teams is how much are you going to change depending on what your opponent does? Like, how much are you going to give or not give? And the answer for Lynchburg is they are not going to change. They're going to keep going at you. They're going to keep fighting. They're going to keep going. And I think you saw that in the Wesleyan game, too. There was no capitulation at any point from them. So, again, you know, as much as it probably, like, hurts me a little bit to say this, I was impressed with Lynchburg, man. The comeback against Stevenson, listen, the game-tying goal was the worst sub change I think I've ever seen in my life from Stevenson. So not taking anything away from it. You still had to score it. You still had to run down the field untouched to score. But they still did it, and then they found a way to score the go-ahead goal and then the ice goal, and that was it. And it went from disaster to triumph in 2 minutes. And that's like the mark of a really good team that can do that. So, you know, hats off to Lynchburg in this one. I think that they learned a lot about themselves, just like Matt said.
And also, like, they're the team that, you know, you said, like, you know, Kyle, your point was, you know, part of, like, they know who they are and what they're going to do. Like, they had a game plan against Wesleyan, and they knew that they could stick to it, and it was eventually going to pay off. It did in the third quarter. They got three straight goals in the span of less than 3 minutes to make a game that started to look like maybe it was going to be Wesleyan, was just going to kind of win this low-scoring game, but it wasn't really going to feel that much in doubt. But they scored three goals. You know, I think that they're as good a team as any to kind of break the zone with Kevin Rogers down there and Evan Lombardo. You know, I think they can bust that zone better than most teams can. So I was just really impressed with them. Like, hey, we know who we are. We're going to stick to our game plan. We're going to make adjustments as we need to. But overall, we're Lynchburg. We're going to play you. And we know and we believe that we can beat you with what we have.
So opposite end of the spectrum, no shade being thrown. Let's talk about Stevenson, because I feel like everything you just said sort of is – Stevenson's not there yet. They haven't figured it out. So the two teams really haven't touched on are Stevenson and York. Let's start with Stevenson, who, just looking ahead, this recording this on Tuesday, it'll come out tomorrow, but they're playing Tufts tonight in Baltimore. They're sitting at, what, 1-5 right now. You know, similar season to last year, except they won a couple of these. So, you know – What did you see from them? What do they need to improve on? What is, you know, I feel like we always talk about their run and gun. They're going to, you know, live by the sword, die by the sword. You know, they're going to try to take as many shots as possible. Is that still what you saw this weekend? And what do they need to do to take that next jump to, you know, maybe get a win tonight against a team like Tufts?
Matt, you can take that one.
Yeah. So, you know, I didn't watch the Lynchburg-Stevenson game. I was able to watch the York-Stevenson game, where York won that one 12-4, and I kind of felt like York was in control pretty much this whole time. But to your point, they're so close, but they just don't quite have the discipline there yet to be, you know, among these elite teams, and they just don't have the overwhelming talent to make up for it that they have had in some other years. You know, a lot of times they could take so many shots. Even if they want, you know, even if they missed on this possession, hey, we're getting it back, and we have
Caleb Robinson's about to go down the field, track you down, and give it back to the offense.
Right, exactly. You know, I don't think they had that, especially like on the defensive end. I don't think they quite have that. You know, Kyle, you mentioned the mean poles at Amherst. I don't get that vibe from them as much anymore. Not that they aren't that, but just they don't have that combined with just the extreme level of talent that someone like Robinson had, that, you know, hey, I'm going to be in your ear the whole time, but guess what? I'm going to actually take it away from you. They don't quite have that level yet. So the only way to get to that level, though, is to play against York and to play against Lynchburg and to play against Tufts and to play against Salisbury early in the season. I mean, they're not that far off, but there's definitely a talent gap there that doesn't really allow them to play the way that they've played in past years, that I think they kind of maybe need to figure out how they're going to adjust to that as they get into conference play.
Yeah, I was actually really impressed. If we're looking for bright spots here, Sam Ross and Cage for them was pretty incredible. I was really impressed with his performance. I think they lean on him a lot to make saves. I think what Stevenson does, they try to lure you into playing super fast because that's where they're comfortable. And it made sense that against a team like York, that was never going to happen because of how drilled and disciplined York is with the ball and without the ball. Everybody knows where they're supposed to go at all times. That team, my takeaway from this weekend watching York play in these two games, they are, I don't know if talent-wise, they are at a level with a lot of these other teams, but it doesn't matter. You know, like, they're so disciplined and so well-coached and so prepared that talent almost stops being an issue. Like, if you lined up the York players against the RIT players, which, you know, we got a chance to see that on film when they played each other, it was like dudes that are 6'5", and everyone on York is like 5'8", 200 pounds. So that's my kind of dude. That's basically what I am. So, like, I'm into that. But at the same time, not everyone can be that size at every position. Like, you need to have a little bit more ranginess in your athleticism. And I think that York totally overcomes that with their regimen and everything else that they do.
That point is so well taken, because I remember when I played them, they had this like cowboy look where they called it cowboy. They would try to get you to dodge to the middle of the field where, you know, you're really taught to, all right, push the guy down the alley, make sure he can bang the deck side, don't go up the middle. They would try to cause this chaos in the middle where they're like, all right, we dare you to dodge to the middle because we're going to jump you real quick, turn the ball over, and play the way we want to play. And to your point about this York-Stevenson game, York is so well coached. I don't think they're overcoached. They're so well coached, and you're right. I think from a talent standpoint compared to RIT, maybe they're not there, you know, one to one, but they're gonna make the right decision 9.5 times out of 10. And when you're playing a team like Stevenson, those decisions, where they, you know, necessarily relate to goal after goal after goal, they're gonna wear it down. Stevenson's not a team that wants to play defense for, you know, the shot clock. They don't want to play 80 seconds. They don't want to play 60 seconds of defense. They want to play 30 seconds, get the ball on the carpet, and push it upfield. So those contrasting sort of styles certainly favor, you know, Coach Childs' is Spartan squad.
Kyle, your point about Sam Ross, the craziest stat of the weekend is the first quarter of that York-Stevenson game, York took 20 shots, which is just absurd for that team to take 20 shots in one quarter. Sam Ross had 10 saves in the first quarter of that game. So really, like, Stevenson was forced to play, you know, these defensive stands that were not just 80 seconds long, but, you know, 220 seconds long, because they were getting a save and York was getting a rebound and playing another long possession and then taking another shot. So really, it did kind of play into York's hands to some extent, but that was just an incredible stat line. And Sam Ross played a heck of a game. He had to face a lot of rubber, considering, you know, the face-off discrepancy with Billy Sasso taking the draws for York. You know, he had 10 of 18 in that game. It was kind of like a slow burn this game. York eventually got momentum in the third and the fourth and really started pouring in goals. But, you know, Stevenson was able to kind of at least make York work for them in a way that was frustrating for the Spartans. But, Kyle, going along with your point, there wasn't a team that I felt more clear about their identity than I did with York coming out of this. You know, Lynchburg to some extent, but York just felt like it's everything we've talked about York we saw exactly play out in front of us. The thing with the RIT game that I didn't see that you saw is, what's up with maybe their ability to play at different paces? Did you see that they have the ability to run with the team or no?
I think that they need to control everything. Do you know what I mean? I think they're a team that, and actually I made this point on the In the Crease podcast with Dan Amer, and that's out, that came out on Tuesday, that the one thing that they're the team they're most similar to in Division One is Towson, because they have all these gritty, like grimy, off the ground, like beast men just like patrolling it. And it's not just Poles. It's not just D-mids. It's not just the face-off guy. Everyone on that team is like that. They're just like animals that want the ball, you know? And I think that when you, the way they play, they need to win certain battles to win certain wars, right? And sometimes they don't get that. And then the next thing they do is they just turn it up a little bit. You know, they will throw in a trap ride. They will zone up a defense. They'll make you take a bad shot. They'll get a quick clear, and then all of a sudden they're fast. And then the next possession they get, they slow it down. You know, they like to really control every aspect of the game. And I think they're at their best when they're winning the GB battle. That's a team that, you know, and this is not a knock. It's a team that needs to win the GB battle to win games. There are teams that are like that, and there are teams that are not like that. Like, I don't think RIT is even like that. They it helps them. It obviously helps anybody that wins the ground ball battle. But I think that, you know, a team like Lynchburg isn't even like that. You know, they have enough talent to kind of pull out wins with timely goals, and they have great isolation players. I don't think York has amazing isolation players. And I didn't know that before this game, but or any of the games they played, but watching them play, it was very apparent that their dodges aren't to get to cage. They're what dodges are meant to be, which is to get your hands free and make a decision. And York, by and large, makes the right decision. I can't hammer this point home enough. It's very impressive. And Josh, I think, you know, as a coach, like, the one thing you want from your guys is to make the right decisions, because you can't bestow upon them talent. You know, you can't make a kid faster in like 1 week. You can't make a kid stronger. But what you can do is kind of reinforce the mental side of the game. And I think that's where York is at their best.
The team that we haven't talked a lot about, and we'll just touch on them quickly, is the defending national champion, Wesleyan. Kyle, I made this comment to you right before they started scoring a ton of goals against Middlebury, that, and I was wrong, you know, or misguided maybe is the better word. But at the beginning of that game, I was like, you know, this team doesn't really jump off the page at me. You know, there's nothing about them that I'm like, oh my God, Wesleyan is really good and it's going to win the national championship. Yet I'm coming out of this weekend thinking just that wow, this is a team that grew a lot this weekend, has an identity, can play really well, and has some tremendous lacrosse players on this team. Why was what I was seeing the case, Kyle? Well, you know, why is it that I was looking at them at the beginning of this event and thinking, this team is just okay? What is it about them?
Because Wesleyan wants you to think that. Honestly, like, I'm not even being facetious. Like, this is a team that lulls you into thinking you're getting an open shot. That's what their zone does. Their zone is very great at giving you looks that they want you to have. Not the ones that you want, the ones that they want you to have. They've got a great keeper in Otto Bowen, who I've been calling Bohan the whole time, so shout to Dragon Ball Z fans. Sorry about that, but... Sorry, I'm definitely calling you by the wrong name. But he was incredible in both games. I think offensively for Wesleyan, obviously Carter Hawthorne's the guy for them. He's their distributor. But I thought Ronan Jacoby took some weird shots, had some wild looks. But that's also part of what they do, is they take shots to get the ball to the other side of the field sometimes. Does that make sense? They love coming out of the backside and feeding, right? That's where Carter Hawthorne's the best. So if you're trying to shut him, what's the best way to get him the ball? It's the Lyle Thompson move, where you take a wild shot that is a shot and you back it up by sitting that guy on the end line, and then he gets the ball and comes right back in and he makes a feed and it's a goal. You know, Wesleyan is very good at that. They're very good at like little underrated mini plays, you know, like not like full schemes. Their schemes are still very good, but they're little plays, little picks, little crosses. They're great on broken plays because that's their kind of specialty, is they will make a meal out of every single mistake that you make. And that's why they're good. They I don't think the team has as much talent as last year, but I also think because of that, they're trying to make up for it in different ways. And so far, you know, they're succeeding, except for the loss against Bates.
Carter Hawthorne, can't stress enough how good of a weekend he had. You know, Kyle, to your point, you know, it reminds me of Loyola when they won the championship, that kind of having a righty and a lefty up top and just having someone who can get the ball to them and just fire at will. They have a little bit of that in their offense. But Hawthorne, you know, the whole game, he's this little guy who's kind of creating offense for everyone else around him. And then when it comes down to crunch time, he takes the ball on a restart, dives from behind the crease, up through the crease, and scores this highlight reel goal that is just awesome and wins the game for them. He's just one of those. He's a gamer. He's a guy who is built for those kind of moments. That was really impressive to see. Also, just, you know, five of the six guys who are playing on their defense are new, or new in terms of, you know, maybe they're not freshmen, but they're new in terms of stepping into a new role. You know, they had guys who were, because of the NCAA's stupid rule, sitting in the stands at Gillette Stadium over Memorial Day weekend and not on the bench or on the field. Now they're playing, and they are relied upon to play in this system. Those guys grew up a lot today, and, you know, this is a different team than 3 weeks ago, and, you know, when they lost that game earlier in the season. So this is definitely a team to watch and kind of live up to that national championship defending role.
I think what's interesting, too, is, you know, when the NCAA selection committee is making decisions about where teams are ranked, who's in, who's out, the in-region record is really, really important, right? Your wins in the South, if you're a Southern team, and your wins in the North are, as a Northern team, are really important. So for Wesleyan to be 2-0, has all the momentum in the world just being 2-0 in an event in an environment like that, but also picking up a big Northern win, which is also a NESCAC win, I think there's even more reason to be, you know, have a lot of confidence for them. This was a big weekend for them in terms of, you know, boosting their overall record, but getting the first conference win, or maybe it's their second, whatever it is, but getting another, you know, big Northern win. And I think that's something you also have to look at a little bit, is Denison goes 0-2, losing to, you know, they lose a Southern game. F&M loses a Southern game. So those are other things to think about when you're looking at the scheme of things, because the Centennial Conference and the ODAC are going to be really competitive. The NESCAC's going to be really competitive. So these Northern wins, especially the ones that could be potentially in conference, which I believe Wesleyan Middlebury was the only one, are really big moving forward. And I don't know if that's the right segue to talk about moving forward, because I think there are some really big in-region games happening this week. But I think that's another reason, Matt, why you feel a little more confident in Wesleyan than maybe you did coming off the loss to Bates.
Yeah, definitely. And even though I think it's easy to say Amherst was the winner of the event in terms of they beat the best team, I think Wesleyan was the winner in the sense that, yes, they went 2-0. Yes, they got a Northern win. But also, I think they just built a tremendous amount of confidence for a team that needed confidence. And that is a perfect segue into looking ahead, because, you know, the Mustang Classic's not the only thing going on. This kind of parlays into the second season in the sense of, you know, we have a lot of conference play, you know, a lot more in-region play, and a lot of stuff to look forward to. The game that I'm circling most is Friday, York versus Cabrini. Southern matchup. Cabrini is as good as it's ever been. York, we've talked about them a lot on this podcast. You know, definitely a team that can make some waves. Josh, what do you think of this game?
I think it has the potential to be a game that we look back when we are seeing where teams are ranked for the NCAA selection show, who's in, who's out, as a game you have to circle as, like, this is the point where these decisions were made. You know, in terms of the South and the rankings right now, I think you could argue that Salisbury, Cabrini, York are the top three in that order. Cabrini's next two games are York and Salisbury. So Salisbury also has to play York in conference. So there'll be an AQ sort of wrinkle thrown to that. You know, Salisbury, if they win their conference, or York ends up winning the conference, they're automatically in. So I think if Cabrini beats York, there's no doubt in my mind that they are the number two seed in the South, assuming that Salisbury continues to just kind of roll through their schedule, which I don't think they will. Salisbury-York later in the season will be an amazing game. But I totally agree with you. I think Cabrini is like the wild card. They're the, you know, Always Sunny fans. They're the Charlie Kelly in this situation. They have the zone. Teams are not as familiar with them. They're going to roll through their conference schedule as they have done. I know they're in a different conference this year, but they're still going to roll. They're just a team that you can't put your finger on, but in a good way, right? Like we talk about not being able to put our finger on Stevenson, but not necessarily the most positive way. They got guys. I know they have a few injuries. The Timmy Brooks kid I know went down recently. I'm not sure whether he's planning on coming back, but they're just a team that they're hard to put a finger on. They're really efficient. They can shoot the crap out of the ball. I think they're a team that no one wants to play right now. So I think the Cabrini-York game will be awesome, and I think the implications moving forward are going to be really, really big. And then, you know, they play Salisbury on March 27th. So we're going to be sitting here on April 1st and have a really clear picture of what needs to happen for each team in terms of them, hey, we're going to win our AQ. Okay, if we don't, these are the wins we have stacked up against each other, because there's probably three or four teams in most of these top conferences that are really competing for an AQ. So it's going to be really interesting to shake that out. And it's cool that in, you know, 10 days from now, we'll probably have a lot more information and a much clearer picture than we do sitting here on March 19th.
Another South game to look at is Ursinus versus Gettysburg. You know, this is one that we probably wouldn't have had circled if we were doing this podcast as a preseason podcast, but Ursinus has come on really strong. You know, I wrote a story with Coach Gary Mercadante, and he was a guest on this podcast just a few weeks ago. Tough defense. Definitely have a few attackmen who are kind of leading the way for them, but I really think it's kind of been just one of those hard-nosed teams that has an ability to hold teams under 10 goals. They've only given up 10 goals once this year. That was a 12-10 win against Christopher Newport. They're still undefeated. I think they definitely have a legitimate shot at beating Gettysburg. Not sure how things are going with Gettysburg right now. It seems like there's just a little bit of maybe some chemistry or things just aren't necessarily clicking 100% for them right now. So this is definitely going to be a good game to watch. And then going back up to the north, but being played in the south, Wesleyan continues its spring break, and they have a Cortland team that they're going to be playing in Florida this weekend. So that's another one to keep an eye on. But Kyle, I think arguably the biggest game of this weekend is one that you're going to be going to, a Division II contest, Merrimack versus Lemoyne. I don't know. It's tough to find a better rivalry over the past five seasons than these two teams. What do you think?
Yeah, these guys hate each other. And it's funny, I've known that for a long time. You know, I coached two seasons in the NE10, one with St. A's and one with Franklin Pierce. And, you know, we would hear stories on the other team about these teams' games all the way back then. So, you know, both teams have a loss. Merrimack's most recently losing to LIU Post, who saw the greatest faceoff performance I've ever seen in my life from their faceoff man to beat Merrimack. I think that, you know, Lemoyne's only lost one game, and it was at Mercy, and it was their first game. And they probably – that's not a game that anyone had circled as, you know, a stumbling block for Lemoyne, but here we are. And, you know, Mercy's turned out to be an excellent team as well. But, you know, Lemoyne has scored 21 goals or more in their last three games straight. They beat AIC 21-1, Bentley 21-7. And former power New York Tech 23-7. They have Matt Hutchings, who's a midfielder, he's a junior. He has 34 points so far this year. Absolutely incredible. On the other side of the ball, I mean, you start and end. I can't say enough good things about him. I feel like I'm like talking about Charlie Bertrand too much, but he's incredible. He's incredible. And I said this, and people were kind of looked at me crazy. And I said in the office this weekend, Charlie Bertrand starts at midfield for an ACC team, and he's here for Merrimack, just tearing into people as an attackman, carrying, dodging, distributing, shooting, scoring, finishing, absolutely a do it all player on all points of Merrimack's offense. He doesn't just operate from one kind of place, which a lot of players have their comfort zone. I don't know what Charlie Bertrand's comfort zone is, because he's comfortable all over the field. This is a dude that can score on anyone, can dish over anyone's head. He's got size, he's got speed. He's definitely the guy to watch for Merrimack. I think the rest of Merrimack's kind of, shall we say, special teams needs to catch up with their offense. And against Lemoyne, that's going to be a tough ask, because the Lemoyne defense, as always, is stout. They're kind of actually a team that, you know, in their conference, and people up here know them for having a great defense first, and then kind of their offense follows. And if you look back even in the last 15 years at the championships that they've won in Division II, it's been the defense that has kind of pushed them forward and that hard-nosed mentality. And that's something they just never lose under Coach Sheehan.
Coach Sheehan, I know I've said this many times. There are few guys I have as much respect for as a coach than Coach Sheehan. Incredible coach. You know, you're going to see a really physical, tough game between these two opponents. I can't imagine this being a scenario where one team rolls the other. And these teams are going to play each other maybe two more times, maybe one more time, whether the NE10 tournament or the NCAA tournament or both. These are the class of Division II right here, at least in the North. And increasingly, there's an increasingly tough South team that, you know, it's very likely that one of these teams is going to play in the national championship game. But first, it's this weekend. Kyle, make sure they're following you on Twitter. You'll be at in North Andover, Massachusetts for this one. So make sure you're following at the Kyle Devitt. We're going to come back next week, refreshed after the Mustang Classic and this weekend's game, and talk some more D2 and D3. But it was a heck of a weekend. Thanks for listening.
This is the Division II, Division III podcast.